From The Recount, I'm Rena Ninen, and you're listening to The Recount Daily Pod. Today's Thursday, August 19th.
But I think we are going to go through a period where government is being used as the weapon of resentment among classes and peoples, and that will be a brutally bad time for democracy everywhere.
That was Tom Nichols, contributing writer at The Atlantic and author of Our Own Worst Enemy, The Assault from Within on Modern Democracy. We'll get into that in a moment, but first, your morning headlines. We start in the United Arab Emirates, where ousted Afghan President Ashraf Ghani spoke for the first time since fleeing the country on Sunday. He said his reason for leaving was to prevent further bloodshed after the Taliban assumed control. He also denied reports that he stole large sums of money on his way out. The main focus for remaining U.S. forces, currently numbering about 4,500, continues to be on the evacuation of Americans, allies, and Afghans who have worked side by side with the U.S. Approximately 5,000 people have been evacuated from Kabul since Sunday. The ability of Afghans to safely reach Kabul airport continues to be precarious. At a Pentagon briefing, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Mark Milley, responded to the wide criticism leveled at the administration about the speed by which the Taliban takeover took place.
There was nothing that I or anyone else saw that indicated a collapse of this army and this government in 11 days.
Meanwhile, isolated protests have started to pop up in various cities across Afghanistan. One took place in the eastern city of Jalalabad, where local residents attempted to install Afghanistan's national flag in a public square, chanting, "God is great and long live the flag." Taliban forces fired at the protesters, killing three and wounding dozens. The U.S. hit a notable vaccine milestone today, with over 200 million Americans, or 60% of the population, receiving at least one dose of the vaccine. This news comes as President Biden announced that booster shots will be available for most Americans starting on September 20th. It's recommended for people 8 months after receiving their last Moderna or Pfizer shot. Johnson & Johnson is still reviewing data before they make any recommendations. President Biden also announced a vaccination mandate for all nursing home staff in order for the homes to receive Medicare and Medicaid funding moving forward. And now to our daily deep dive. Deep divisions in American politics and culture are everywhere these days, from Congress to state capitals, from school boards to city councils. But are these divisions threatening the very survival of our democracy? And if so, what can be done about it? Joining me today, Tom Nichols, contributing writer at The Atlantic and author of Our Own Worst Enemy, The Assault from Within on Modern Democracy. Tom, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
When you talk about our own worst enemies, who are you talking about? How are they assaulting our democracy?
Well, I'm talking about all of us in every advanced and highly developed democracy throughout the world, from the United States to India to Poland, to Australia, to Canada. Even though we don't think of it this way, we are living in a time of remarkable affluence, relative peace, certainly compared to the 1960s and 70s. And we have gotten used to an immensely high standard of living, even the very poorest among us. And we have become a danger to our own democracy because our expectations, our sense of entitlement, our narcissism, which is really the pandemic that is fueling the pandemic that we're dealing with now, have all combined to make us less civic, less caring, really into making us less able citizens. And we can't sustain a democracy on narcissism and entitlement. We simply can't go on this way.
There's a term you throw around in the book. It's called illiberalism. What is it?
Illiberal democracy is when a lot of people vote and vote for things that are intolerant and would eventually end democracy down the line. It's not a democracy if the last vote you have is to end democracy. People tend to confuse majority rule with democracy. There are a lot of countries that have majority rule and have elections and ballot boxes and courts and other trappings of democracy. What makes liberal democracy the miracle that it's been for 250, 300 years is that liberal democracies put guardrails in place that say, no, you can't have a majority vote to deprive other people of their rights. You cannot take a majority vote to deprive other people of their citizenship. You can't have a majority vote to silence the other 49% of the people. And I think, again, this is where we have become our own worst enemy. We say, well, if we just all vote and 51% of us agree, it doesn't matter if we've all agreed to something terrible. That's why liberal democracies tend to be constitutional democracies, because we agree to be bound by a constitution that tells us where the edges of that behavior are. And at least a lot of Americans don't understand their own constitution anymore.
When you talk about the edge of illiberalism, how do you make people more tolerant of one another? Take an issue like voting rights, for instance. One group of people really believes the other side is so wrong on this topic. How do you ever get them to connect?
Well, the problem is it's a slow process. I think the other thing that we always have to get past in our minds is that eventually you can convince everyone to be tolerant and secular and understanding, cooperative, respectful, all of the things that we value in a liberal democracy. If you go back to 1965, nobody believed that the Civil Rights Act was going to magically melt the hearts of racists. But in accordance with the Constitution that we all live under and the Declaration of Independence and our other founding documents that say, you know, we to create a more perfect union and that all human beings are endowed with certain inalienable rights, you pass this legislation and you acclimatize people to say, look, you're just going to have to understand that you cannot treat people as less than human because of the color of their skin. Some people get it right at the outset. Some people eventually get used to the idea that they're seeing in the behavior of their fellow citizens. But some people will never do that. And that's always a problem in a democracy. But what we didn't used to do was to try to wrap government around the hardest core of illiberal elements and somehow placate them. And we're doing that now, I think, in a way that's really unhealthy.
You also talk in your book about political entrepreneurs, people who thrive on the creation of rage rather than encouraging any sort of civic virtue or democratic cooperation. What is a political entrepreneur? Can you explain that?
This is someone who speaks to the irrational and emotional side of large numbers of people in order to detach them from values such as the Constitution or liberality or tolerance and attach them to their own political fortunes. You see it here in the United States. You saw it with Trump. You see it in Hungary with Orban, in Turkey with Erdogan. People who say, I am not here to represent all the people. I'm here to just represent you. And those other people aren't really the people. This is very much the populist manipulation. And part of the reason I call them political entrepreneurs is that most of these populists across the world are actually quite wealthy and supported by extremely wealthy people. These are not grassroots populists. And they say, we're the real people. And those other people aren't really people. They're not really the citizens. And that's a kind of entrepreneurship that says, and when you do that, remember to empower me, send me money, give me a lot of individual power. But I want to make one thing clear. Right now in the United States, that illiberal impulse is concentrated on the American right. But this is not necessarily a strictly partisan phenomenon. When you have people that are tearing down statues of Thomas Jefferson and Ulysses Grant as a form of kind of political self-actualization, while they're bored and rioting, you know, this is performative, narcissistic drama, and it is spread in all countries.
How do you get people in a society who cannot see the other side at all to be more supportive or more tolerant, I guess, is probably the more accurate word?
I was really afraid you were going to ask me this. Because, you know, in a book like this, at the end, I'm supposed to say, all is well.
Yeah.
It's going to be fine. You know, smarty pants, intellectual guys like me have figured it all out. I haven't figured it all out. We may well have a problem with a demographic that is closer to I'm 60 years old. That demographic may just be irretrievable at this point and may just die out over the next 10 or 15 years and be replaced by a different demographic of voters who enter the pool. I actually thought that something like a pandemic would actually bring us to our senses.
Yes,
and force
absolutely
us to cooperate.
Right.
And I was horribly wrong about this. I wrote a book before this one called The Death of Expertise, where I talked about how people resist expert advice and don't believe in science and this whole epistemic crisis we're living through. And I said, but you know, a war, a depression, a pandemic would probably snap us out of it. It hasn't, but I also think that it's building a stronger foundation for civic behavior among the people that have lived through this. And I think that the number of people who are really clinging to that uncivic behavior, that might be a hard knot of 20 or 30% of the public. I have mixed feelings about this, but I also think that the public culture we've developed over 40 years of kind of conspicuous non-judgmentalism has to go. I think it's okay to be a little more judgmental. I think when people are uncivic, when they say repellent or contemptuous things, we have to respond to that and to put those social guardrails back in place. We can't just wave that away. Some of this is very intangible, but we can't just wave that away by saying, well, you know, agree to disagree, or, you know, we all have a view. The United States was a country that used to advocate within its own borders for its own kind of civic virtue. And I think we've stopped doing that. And it's not just education. It's not just more civics classes. You know, it's turning to your fellow citizen to say, that's an un-American thing to say. We have to reclaim notions like patriotism and American and national and words like that, that I think have been hijacked by people who now use them as tribal signifiers when they should really apply to all of us.
We've got to take a quick break, but we'll be back with Tom Nichols, contributing writer at The Atlantic and author of Our Own Worst Enemy, The Assault from Within on Modern Democracy. You're listening to The Recount Daily Pod. Welcome back to The Recount Daily Pod, a podcast from The Recount and iHeartRadio. We're here with Tom Nichols, contributing writer at The Atlantic and author of Our Own Worst Enemy, The Assault from Within on Modern Democracy. Tom, if government is broken, how do you rebuild trust?
I reject the premise of that question. Government is not broken. It is amazing to me how often people who say, well, the government's broken, rely on government at every level, local, state, and federal. Every time they get on an elevator that's been inspected, every time they get on a bus whose driver has a license, every time they go to an airport, every time they turn on their taps and get clean water. Everybody can do that because Americans forget that in a lot of places in the world, nobody can do that. And this is a theme of the book. This level of entitlement and expectation has become so high that we think that every time the government gets something wrong, every failure of policy is this gigantic, dramatic proof that government is broken. And that's simply not the case.
You're a former Republican. Give me a sense, how did your background inform your approach to writing and researching this book?
This was the hardest book I ever wrote because I come from the working class. My parents were Depression-era kids. My mom dropped out of high school in the ninth grade. My dad dropped out in 10th. I grew up in a dying factory town, playing in abandoned factories and coal yards. And so when people talk about the anger toward government and toward the modern world, I understood that. I get that. On the other hand, that impressed on me how much that isn't an excuse for this kind of illiberal, uncivic, cruel behavior. My parents were not educated people, and yet they never missed an election. Mm-hmm. They walked right down to their polling place and voted in person. I saw people who dealt with really difficult circumstances and yet never abandoned America, the Constitution, or the basic ideals. My father was a bigot. And yet at the end of his life, shortly before he died, he was watching the 2012 election and he nodded. And my father said, they're both good men. We're going to be fine, no matter who wins. And I thought, you know, when you asked me earlier, how do you come back from this? How do people step back from this? This is my father, who had never said a kind thing about African-American people in his life, nodding at the president of the United States and saying, he's a good man. Well, doesn't matter if who wins, we're going to be fine. And I think that made me realize that coming from that kind of background is not an excuse. We have to look at ourselves and those of us on the other side, because I've transitioned from being that working class kid to being one of the elites and to say, Are we doing our part? Are we engaging? Are we saying the things that we need to say in public as public intellectuals, as teachers, as writers? And I point the finger at a lot of folks, and that's where the title of the book came from, unfortunately.
What do you think the future of the Republican Party is?
I don't think the Republican Party has a future. I think that the party that I joined back in 1978 doesn't exist anymore. I think it's gone. I don't know what will take its place. I know people spend a lot of time thinking about the Republican Party that comes out of the Republican Party. I don't think that's going to happen now. I think the more likely probability, and the one that I think is people haven't thought as much about, is that the Democratic coalition is now so large that it's unstable. And I think whatever new political movement is going to emerge, it's going to emerge out of former Democrats and former Republicans who are going to create some kind of coalition or movement.
You sketch out the rise of populist and authoritarian politicians in Hungary, India, Italy, Ukraine. What are some of the similarities that these politicians all share?
They're all fun. They're all interesting. This is the big problem, is that in an affluent, technologically advanced society, the real enemy is boredom. That we have this bored middle class, bored middle to working class, that just wants politics to be a show. And that's what's Orban, Zelensky was a comedian. He literally was a TV comedian playing a president. And so they decided to make life imitate art, and they elected him president. And the thing I would always say is politics, if it's executed well, is boring. And people don't like that. Boris Johnson's a walking circus. Orban, Erdogan, Zelensky, they're all fascinating. They're fun to watch, just like Trump. And unfortunately, that's the basis of their appeal.
You also blame social media for boosting narcissistic traits, fostering social isolation. How does that affect democracy?
When you asked why this was a hard book to write, that's because partly I'm part of the problem. I mean, I have a really large social media profile. So it's like, well, as I said on Twitter the other day about this very problem, but I think the problem is that people are hyper-connected now to strangers. And so, back in 1979, Christopher Lash wrote a book about narcissism, and he said, we are becoming a performative culture, where we do nothing but for the approval of other people around us. Then this was long before social media existed, but that's exactly what's happening, is that social media lets everybody come home from a tough day at work or from, you know, their bored environment where nothing interesting has happened, and they say, I am going to go and be somebody, and I'm going to be somebody interesting. And the way that you are interesting on social media for a lot of people is to be relentlessly negative and attention-seeking. And again, I am a practitioner of this. I bear some of this responsibility. But I think this notion that you don't really spend a lot of time with real people having to hear their problems, hurts, joys, ordinary concerns, and that everything is this million-volt dopamine rush that you get by plugging into social media, I think is absolutely destroying us. And it's destroying us by encouraging us to constantly compare ourselves to everyone else 24 hours a day and to hate them. As I say in the book, we can get from hello to I hate you in record time, faster than any culture in history now.
So ultimately, Tom, does democracy survive the information age?
Another one of those questions where I want to say, yes, it'll be fine. But no, it probably won't be fine. I think that democracy is natural to every human being. Nobody really wants to get up in the morning and be told what to do. Nobody wants to be told who to worship, who they can marry, where they can go. But I think we are going to go through a period where government is being used as the weapon of resentment among classes and peoples. And that will be a brutally bad time for democracy everywhere. And I think we're only partway through that dark tunnel. And I think there's a lot more road ahead of us, unfortunately. How long or short that tunnel is will depend on a lot of choices that we're all about to make in the next few years.
Tom Nichols, contributing writer at The Atlantic and author of Our Own Worst Enemy, The Assault from Within on Modern Democracy. Tom, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And now to the look ahead. Here's what else we're watching today. Human trials for Moderna's HIV vaccine are scheduled to begin today. The trial is expected to be complete by spring 2023. It'll be the first for HIV to use mRNA technology, the same technology successfully used for companies' COVID-19 vaccine. 38 million people currently live with HIV. Attempts to develop a vaccine have been ongoing for 37 years, though none have been successful to date. Tesla CEO Elon Musk will be the keynote at his company's AI, or Artificial Intelligence Day, tonight. It's an opportunity for investors, the media, and consumers to get an up-close look at what's under development. Among the updates, more details on Tesla's full self-driving beta software, which started showing up on more roads this summer. New York's Empire State Building, the Tokyo Skytree, and the London Eye will be lit up purple tonight. It's to show support for the hashtag WeThe15 campaign, which aims to transform the lives of 1 billion people, or 15% of the world's population, that have disabilities. Organizers hope that the visual stunt will raise awareness, helping to end discrimination and elevate the lives of the disabled in truly inclusive societies. Have a great day, everyone. I'll see you back on Monday morning. This is a Recount Daily Pod, a podcast from The Recount and iHeartRadio. Our thanks to Tom Nichols for being on the show. And if you like this episode, I hope you'll subscribe to The Recount Daily Pod and leave us a rating on the Apple Podcast app. I'm your host, Rena Ninen. Alexis Ramdow and Corey Wara engineered and produced this podcast. Ariella Martin also produced. Fonda Mwangi did the research. And our executive producer is Laura Beatty.